We'd like to thank the organizer for this great workshop and giving me also the opportunity to speak here. So I'm in the very convenient position of giving a talk after many other talks that contain some aspects that are related to what I'm trying to expose now. So much of material has been already seen in one way or another already. So so we saw many probability measures, or sometimes not probability measures, but just measures on paths or loops or interfaces. And one of the common themes was that when we got one single interface, then there was this SAD parametrization that was a very effective way to describe these certain class of paths, say in a simply connected domain joining two boundary points. And for a whole range of discrete models, either it has been proved or it is conjecture that SAD give the scaling limit, is the distribution of the scaling limit of the discrete model. So now a fairly natural question, especially in many statistical mechanics models, is that the model, I mean, one interface is only a sort of small marginal of the model. If you want the full information about the discrete model, we need much more than one interface, but something more like a collection of interfaces. So I think so a collection of interfaces now, maybe we have CLEs to describe them, but we can try some intermediate approach between describing just one interface and describing the full collection of all interfaces by just trying to sample, to select the finite number of microscopic interfaces and try to describe them. So if we are in the nice situation where we really understand one single interface, say for critical calculation and as a triangular lattice or uniform spanning tree, for instance, then we can expect that with only little additional work, we'd be able to work out a joint law of a finite number of those interfaces. So that's the main point of this work. It worked today. So SAD has been, well, the common themes have been already defined. So I just try to discuss it in a way that will suit my later purposes. So imagine that we're looking for families mu of probability distributions indexed by a set of configurations. So we'll start from this very simple topological constraints where we want just a simply connected domain in the plane with two distinct boundary points. And we want to define for every such configuration a probability measure that is supported on paths connecting A to B within B. And we just ask two axioms, so just glossing over continuity details, for instance. So we just ask for two axioms. So the first one is conformal invariance, that relates probability measures corresponding to conformally equivalent configurations. So if you've got two conformally equivalent configurations, then you can transport your probability measure indexed by the first one to the probability measure indexed by the equivalent configuration by just pushing the distribution of your path using this conformal equivalent. And then, so discussed by Greg this morning, the special Markov property that tells you that if you condition by a small slit of the path, then the complement corresponds to your family, your probability distribution in the restricted domain. So you want to go from A to B, and then you condition on the small slit of the, this, say, interface going from A to B. So this gives you a conditional law, and you want this conditional law to agree with the law of the interface in the smaller domain when you remove the slit and just change the initial point. So this is a way to see this domain Markov property. And then we've got these Lovenard's equations, and Lovenard's equations are a sort of toolbox that allows to convert non-self-traversing paths in simply connected domains into real-valued processors. So if we just rephrase this in terms of real-valued processors, then we're trying to classify Levy processors that are continuous, that have Brownian scaling. And this we know, it's a standard process theory result that these processors are just proportional to a Brownian motion. So we've got 1 degree of freedom, which is the value of the kappa parameter. So now let's take a look at what happens when we're looking at configuration spaces that are a little more complicated. So say we're looking at all simply connected domains D in the plane with a certain arbitrary number of points marked on the boundary. And then we want to, so we've got two types of points, so the X points and the Z points. So the Z points are just, trying to influence the interpreters from afar. But at all the X points, so the X points are sort of seeds of interfaces. So we want to define collection of interfaces going at all the X points. So now we can sort of extend the previous axiomatics to this situation. So now we want still conformal invariants. So when we've got two equivalent configurations, and then we want that the probability distribution on my left hand is transported by conformal equivalence to corresponding probability distribution for the other configuration. And then we want a similar domain Markov property, which is to say if we condition these interfaces on some initial slits, and we look at the remaining interfaces in the complementary domain, then we've got the probability distribution corresponding to this restricted domain. And then we make some regularity assumption that what we see in the neighborhood of the seed is in fact something which has which has a density with respect to some SAD kappa. So SAD kappa I, where kappa I can depend on different seeds can correspond to different kappas a priori. Okay, so now what we want really, so in the previous slide we saw that when we had these configurations with only two mark points, then we could classify the solution by one single parameter, kappa. So now what we want to see is whether we can classify also solutions to this problem by a finite number of parameters, for instance. So just start by reviewing a few discrete models. So with, we've heard a lot, in fact, about many intriguing new continuous models, but we can go back to basics and then discuss some easy discrete models. So this is a percolation on D-square, as was discussed by Vincent earlier in the week. So this is this is equivalent to a calculation on this square if you take a slant square lattice. So in this picture, what I do is that I set some boundary conditions, some semi-boundary conditions. So these are deterministic boundary conditions, like this. So these collection of half circles on the boundary are just my boundary conditions, and then every square in the bulk is tiled using a random tiling. So I've got two tiles. Like this, with two quarter circles joining middle of edges. And I take probability, and so I just flip coins for each square of the tiling, and this is equivalent to calculation z square on this other lattice. So this is just to emphasize the self-duality properties of the square lattice. So now, so the whole point of my choice of boundary conditions is that I've got an even number of points. So in this example, 8 points on the boundary where I create open interfaces. So you see that what I've got inside is a collection of some closed loops. So this is a very closed loop here. You've got a bit larger loop and a bit larger loops. So these are closed loops, and I've got also open paths that start at these 8 open points on the boundary. So you see that if you start from an open point, your only possibility is to end at another open point on the boundary, so somewhere. So let's see, we're going. We end up there. So we've got these four macroscopic interfaces. So you see that now we can hope to take a scaling limit, and we've got these four interfaces that we want to study in the scaling limit and see what are the properties of their joint distribution. So in the situation where I've got these two open points on the boundary, calculation gives me a random pairing of these two endpoints. So I've got n open paths connecting these two endpoints. I've got a pairing of these two endpoints on this boundary. So this pairing is random. Probability should be bounded below and above, so strictly above 0 and strictly below 1 by standard Russo-Semowage theory. So this is rigorous, and then this should go to a non-degenerate scaling limit that should be conformally invariant, the general line of thinking. And if you've got only 4 points on the boundary, so this is completely equivalent to a Cardy formula over this square. So if you want to know, so this is true when as soon as Vincent puts enough work in it. And in the general case, we've got a certain number of possibilities for these pairings, and some are ruled out for topological reasons. So for instance, if we get only 4 points, then we get 2 only possible pairings. Corresponding to the existence of left to right or top to bottom crossings in the lattice and the dual lattice. But you see that that the forbidden pairing like this, because topologically it's impossible to pair these two points. So if you try to count the number of topologically admissible pairings, then you get a standard combinatorial object Catalan's numbers that gives you the total number of topological possibilities for pairing. Okay, so this is for calculation, but then we can look in our bag of discrete models, and probably one of the maybe the best understood model from the SLE perspective is given by the pair of models, uniform spanning tree, looping rest random walks. So this is, so if you remember Michael Cojon's talk, so this would be very familiar. So what I do in this picture is that I take a rectangle, which is a subset of this square. I set boundary conditions on the outside, so all the perimeter of the rectangle is wired, as you see. And then I sample uniformly from a subset of this rectangle that are spanning, so that connect here, well, that touch every vertex of the rectangle, and that have no cycles. So this is a uniform spanning tree. And now I've got four marked points, four marked vertices. And I look at the subtree of my uniform spanning tree that contains these four vertices. So there's a minimal subtree of my uniform spanning tree that connects these two vertices. And then you see that, okay, so this one, it's later, so it's a little fatter solid line connects to this point, and this one, well, connects to that point. And then, in this particular realization of my uniform spanning tree, I don't have any triple points in this minimal subtree. So it could have been that these two points were connected to this point, and then somewhere in the bulk, I got a triple point. So if I want to compute the probability that I don't get any triple points, then this, the job is done by Fomin's formula. So we call that Fomin's formula a sort of loop-erase version of the Karin-McGregor non-intersection formula for cyclic networks. So we've got this formula, and if the points are in the right order on the boundary, we get essentially this formula. So this is in the upper half plane. So if you have a finite configuration, you can replace this by the Poisson extortion kernel to get the exact formula. So in this situation, I just condition by this event, but so the event that the tree is of this topological type. And if I condition by given that the tree is of exactly this topological type, then I've got these two simple paths in the domain, and I've got two non-intersecting simple paths in this domain, and now I can try to take a look at that joint scaling limit. So of course I could do this with any number of points. Okay. So next in my catalog is uniform spanning trees. So uniform spanning trees converge to SLE8 when you've got the proper boundary interfaces, and if you just replicate these boundary interfaces a certain number of times, you get stable interfaces. So let me extend this figure. So I've got in a rectangle, I've got a solid lattice, and in this solid lattice, I take the uniform spanning tree with this particular boundary condition. So everything here is wired, so this is wired. This is free, so equivalently, this is wired in the dual lattice. And then I've got some external wiring connecting everything. So now, in this situation, I've got 1, 2, 3, 4, etc., 8 points open on the boundary. And at each of these points, there's some piano exploration paths that starts and that will end up somewhere. So now, given these boundary conditions, the endpoint is prescribed. So this one must end there, this one must end there, and so on. So, I've got this prescribed prescribed pairing. So now, what I've got are four piano paths that, in the discrete setting, are simple paths. So that will become non-self-traversing in the scaling limit. So they sort of partition the space into four subsets. And locally, so near the start, if I just look around this corner and the scaling limit, what I'll get will have a density with respect to SLE8. Now what I'm asking is, what's the joint law in the scaling limit of all these interfaces? And in this situation, we've got a good control on what happens through Wilson's algorithm. Well, we don't actually need the full force of Wilson's algorithm. We just need a relationship between uniform spanning trees and electrical networks. So basically, if I take just one vertex, so in the middle, on the piano, on the Manhattan lattice, in fact, so if I take a vertex on the Manhattan lattice, it belongs to one of the four interfaces, because the four interfaces sort of form this partition. And if I want to compute the probability that it belongs to the interface corresponding to this segment or this segment, so on and so forth, then I've got an exact identity involving harmonic measure for a certain random walk, and when I take the scaling limit of discrete harmonic measure for this random walk, I'll get harmonic measure with normal reflection on this free boundary components. So there's an observable that I actually know how to compute from this model, but we actually know how to compute, and that has a very nice scaling limit property. So this gives us a good handle on what's going on. Yeah. Okay, so this was for discrete models, but then we also get some continuous realizations following some different properties of SLE. So reversibility tells us that when kappa is less than 8, if you take SLE going from A to B in a domain D and SLE going from B to A in the same domain D, then you get the same path in distribution. So duality relates the boundary of an SLE kappa when kappa is more than 4 with an SLE 16 over kappa. So this was discussed by Bertrand and I guess also other people during this workshop. And we've got some in the case of the duality between kappa equal 2 and kappa equals 8. We've got some very explicit realizations of this identity in distribution following Wilson's algorithm. So locality for SLE6 is really the continuous counterpart of independence for percolation. So this makes life very easy for SLE6. And also more interesting is the restriction property for SLE8 cells. So using the restriction property for SLE8, we can do the following. So we take two independent samples of chordal SLE8 in a simply connected domain. So I take a sample of SLE8 going from A to B and another sample of SLE8 going from C to D, and I just condition on the event that these two traces do not intersect. And just for the reason that SLE8 satisfies the restriction property, this construction actually makes sense and satisfies the axioms that I gave when I began. So this actually works. You can replicate this for any number of SLE8. And when kappa is less than 8, there's a way that has been devised by Lohler, Schramm, and Werner, somehow to extend the restriction property by a random environment, if you want. So we can just add something which will be a soup of loops, a loop soup. So this was discussed by Van Dien in this loop. So if kappa now is less than 8, we can take independent samples of two SLE kappas going from A to B and C to D, a loop soup with appropriate intensity, and now we condition on the event that there is no loop in the loop soup connecting the two traces. And then we forget about the loop soup, and what we get are two non-intersecting interfaces. And this will again satisfy my initial restriction axioms. And this is also completely connected to some formulae. So when kappa is equal to 2, this is very precisely connected to this formulae. And when you've got more than two interfaces, it's slightly more intricate, so you've got to be just a little careful about what you're doing. But using a certain number of loop soups, then you can actually give explicit constructions of such multiple SLEs. So another example, very important example, I guess, that is not on this slide, concerns the Gaussian free field. So Scott showed us how when you took appropriate boundary conditions for the Gaussian free field, then you created level lines that converge to SLE4. So then if you we're in the situation now, we know how to create locally an SLE4 by a change of boundary conditions. So now we just replicate this change of boundary condition a certain number of times. Solid will be plus lambda and dash will be minus lambda. So at each of these seed points, I'm creating some local some interfaces or level lines. And at some point, they'll manage to pair inside the domain into some fashion, so maybe like this. And then I create certain number of interfaces. Each of them will have the density with respect to appropriate SH for me, given the pairing type. Okay, so now we can start using something which has been taught to use to great effect in the situation when we had a simply connected domain with two marked points on the boundaries. So we can use Lovenov's equation to translate information about interfaces in terms of real value processes. So now we've got a certain number of seeds where we grow interfaces, and we make this regularity assumption that at the start we get something which has which is absolutely continuous with respect to some SLE kappa. So you see that in this instance of the Gaussian free field, if we don't put the right value for lambda, we'll also get some sets of interfaces, but they won't satisfy this regularity assumption because there will be some force points hidden at the seed. Right. So for an important technical problem, so we just make this assumption. So I've got two. So if I have density with respect to SLE kappa I, so I must satisfy some SD. So with this Brownian term and also drift term. The real question is, what kind of drift terms can I put to get some reasonable interfaces? So you see that the drift term is, in fact, you can see it as a function of all your mark points, satisfying a very simple condition that it's translation invariant and homogeneous of degree minus one. And so this is the associated infinitesimal generator. So now you just make a trivial remark about the domain Markov property. So the domain Markov property tells you that the distribution, so if you've got two seeds at say xi and xj, you consider the distribution, the joint distribution of two infinitesimal slits starting at xi and xj. So you want to see what is the distribution of these joint seeds, say these two are of size epsilon and epsilon prime. So this is the same thing as, well, this is, you can condition it in two fashion. So you can average okay, so this is a bit notation. So you can average the conditional law given the second slit of the joint realization. Or you can average over the first realization the conditional joint law. And you must get the same result. So another way to say this is that you've got to grow these two small slits. So you can grow either the first one and then the second one, or do it in the reverse order and get the same distribution. But now we've made a hypothesis on all this, so we know that when we grow one slit, we grow it according to SLE kappa with drift term di. And then we've got the domain Markov property that tells us that once we grow the first slit, then we grow the second slit in the complement of the domain. So we've got precise hypothesis on this. So then this, if you look at this infinitesimal condition, because we are looking at the slits of size of order of the same order, so it's epsilon and epsilon prime, we've got this this boils down essentially to this commutation condition. So the bracket is commutator of two differential operators, and we've got a compensation that comes from the distortion of the domain. So when you grow your first infinitesimal slit, you distort the domain at the other one, so you've got to compensate for this to get something that's coherent. So it's an easy computation to see that you get this condition. So now, what are my unknowns? So my unknowns are kappa, the values of kappa, and the drift terms. So the drift terms are in fact functions, so belonging to a large space. And these are my equations on my unknown. So you see that when I take a commutator on two domains, so this is a function, so this will be, I'll get cross quadratic differential equations involving my drift terms. So it's a bit of.
Okay. So I'm just getting confused. So what x and z is what?
Okay, so x and z are marked points of the boundary.
So
and at the x point, you so the x are the seed points and the z are the force points,
okay.
if you prefer this terminology.
Oh, yes, okay.
So I mean, at no extra cost, I can keep track of additional points. And maybe these additional points influence, in some sense, the position of my interfaces. So I allow for this generality. So if you start, expanding this this condition in terms of the BIs, it doesn't really look good, but this is just because you're not writing things in the good coordinates or writing the good unknown. So just by pure algebraic manipulations, you can solve these conditions in the following form. So I've got this pairwise commutation condition for two seeds among my n seeds, and these conditions are satisfied if and if the following happens. So all my kappas must belong to a set made up of only two dual values, so maybe they are all equal, or maybe I've got some duality. So this is a complete algebraic consequence of this just silly little axiom. And then I've got a complete linearization of the problem. So I have these commutation relations that are not at all linear on cross conditions. But they imply in particular that because of cross derivative condition, I can write my drift terms in this Girsanov form as the drift, the log derivative of a common function psi. And now this function psi must satisfy, must annihilate M operators, so one for each growth point. So I've got the standard SLE generator here. I've got something which is a restriction compensation in some sense. So this is well, 1 minus 6 over kappa is minus 2 H12, maybe. It makes, makes things easier. And then I've got some free parameters. So I, as Scott was pointing out, I have boost force points. And all the generality that is added by those force points ends up in these three parameters. But I guess, I mean, maybe Bertrand and John prefer to see this as vertex operators sitting at the VIs. And then if you got a non-vanishing function solution of this system, then you can solve the commutation relation, and this is equivalent. So now we've got some new explicit parameters that are these mu's and u's that were hidden in our conditions. And well, we've got, and still, we just have to solve, to find a non-vanishing solution of these equations. So now it's a completely linear problem. So it's, in a sense, is on. Is, yeah. So Psi, you really should think of it as a partition function. You should really think of it as a partition function. Yeah. Yeah, from the configuration space to R, yeah.
And you're
going to
tell us that for any such function that satisfies these properties,
yeah,
you can concoct one of these.
Yeah, if these equations are satisfied, and then you put bi equals proportional to this log derivative, then the commutation relations are satisfied by purely algebraic manipulation.
And this is the only way.
And this is the only way. Yeah, this is an equivalence.
So this psi, I should think of this as for generating what the drift is, as you draw this path.
Yeah. So you should think in terms of Girsanov. So you get this partition function, and then what are the drifts when you like this, when
the
you
drift
twin?
Is going to be like a gradient.
Yeah. This is a pure Girsanov.
So you're saying, okay, and the mu's and nu's, what are those?
They depend on the force points. Let me give you like just one example. Probabilistic example, and everybody will be. These are weights. So let me give you. Yeah, because you've got. Because infinity. The thing which is maybe a bit obfuscating is that I'm in Cordon notation. So implicitly, infinity is a mark point. So there's a mark point at infinity. So in fact, mu j is the interaction between zj, the point marked at zj, and the point marked at infinity. And nu gk is the interaction between zj and zk. But infinity is like the, you know, n plus 1. I mean, this is purely, for computational purposes. So just let me just give an example. And then things will be completely clear to you. So I've got So I've got this situation where I've got two seeds and three mark points over than my two seeds. So now I'm doing the following thing. So this I'm taking an independent sample of SLE I-third and three restriction measures connecting my three points with different so if this is infinity, say, then this will be you know, this is V1, V2 and infinity, this will be mu 1. So restriction measure with index mu 1, this will be mu 2, and this will be mu 1, 2. So, I mean, just because I normalize at infinity, that I get a different set of parameters, but really it's not important. So, I just now condition my SLE I-third, so going from x1 to x2, right, not to intersect any of those restriction measures. And then I forget about my restriction measure. And I get something that satisfies all my actions if I keep track of my mark points. And then you see that my freedom is completely explained by this parameter. So the indices of this restriction measure. So you can construct, for SLE I-third, you can construct the solutions to all these equations by just, restriction tricks. And I guess that if SLE is less than I-third, then you really have to use these SLE kappa rules. And you've got to decorate SLE kappa rules with loop scoops, but tuning the kappa and the rules and intensity so that everything is...
These are now much more general than SLE kappa
rules. Oh, yeah, because the drift terms are generically transcendental, right?
The drift terms are what?
Generically transcendental functions and not just rational functions. Let me maybe give you just another example, which would be which is very simple in fact. Where you've got only seed points. So this is the situation in Cardi formula, right? So this really doesn't look like SLE6, but these are SLE6. So now I've got four seed points. SLE6, and I just condition on the event that I get this pairing. Take the scaling limit. Look at the drift terms. What are the drift terms? The drift terms are given by log derivatives of Cardy's formula. So log derivatives of Cardy's formula, you see, won't give you SLE kappa rules.
Yeah. So that comes from the
SLE
kappa.
And this would be this equation. So now kappa is 6, so this is 0, this is, so you get just standard percolation. Okay, so let's just go back to this kind of case where you've got only seed points. So this is an extremely interesting particular case. So now forget about putting, Vertex operators or whatever on different points. So we have only seed points, and we've got say two n seed points that got to hook up in some particular fashion. So we've got this PDE, and then now to make things more symmetrical, infinity is no longer a marked point. So I've got full conformal covariance under the Möbius group. So I've got a conjugation by. I've got just a small technical trick to make things symmetrical, but this is really the same system as before. And when kappa is 6, this is a system of PDEs that must be satisfied by scaling limit of Quasing probabilities. If kappa is 8-third, then up to conjugation, so I've got some conjugation factors, this will be satisfied by the probability that say two SLE 8-third do not intersect. And when kappa is less than 8-third, then you just have to average over loop soups and et cetera, and you get probabilistic interpretations of solutions of the system. And I must say that and you should get probabilistic solution that span the solution space, in fact. If this was 0, 0, 0, this would be an obvious invariant, infinitesimal version of an obvious invariant. This is translation invariant, homogeneity, and then the last invariant under inversion near infinity. But then I had to conjugate by a trivial factor to make things symmetrical, because I've got a problem of reference measure. So my reference measure is the product of FAD measures. So I've got to choose a special pairing for my reference measure. And so if I choose a special pairing for my reference measure, then I get equations that are not symmetrical. But I can make them symmetrical by taking conjugation by some factor, and so this becomes not invariant but covariant under the Möbius group. But when kappa is 6, so you see that this is, nothing happens. So this is just conformal invariant when kappa is 6. Okay, so let me discuss a bit. So this is a bit dense slide. So we saw that domain Markov property implied commutation relations for infinitesimal operators, and you can get an algebraic solution of commutation relations for infinitesimal operators using this size function or this partition function. So now, but this is just an infinitesimal relation. So now you can lift an infinitesimal commutation to local commutation. So you can construct FADs that have a positive lifetime. So you can actually start from at least a little bit around each seed point and get this full Markov property jointly in all the seeds. So this is sort of the same thing that you can, you know, if you exponentiate commuting vector fields, then you get commuting semigroups. This is raising this, but technically it's slightly annoying to actually write this, so to get some control over things. So, but this, maybe Scott was pointing this out. So the real issue there, which cannot be handled at all by these methods, is what happens when the SLEs that you start at, all the seeds at some point will crash into each other, or maybe they will crash into mark points. So you really don't know how to handle this. So basically, you say that if you stop your SLEs somewhere, you know, before they can collide together, then you can get these local commutations. But this doesn't tell you how to handle this. So in particular, this will imply reversibility, so it's not a trivial statement. And now, when kappa is less than alpha, then we've got actual realization of measures and joint measures on families of paths that satisfy the actions I was giving in the beginning, using as a reference measure a product of SAD measures. So you take product of SAD measures going from xi to gamma I to yi, then you restrict to a realization where these interfaces do not intersect, then you wait using loops, and you normalize by your partition function. And you get a probability measure on joint close of paths that satisfy all that you want. So this corresponds to a given pairing. So for each geometric pairing, we get this validation, so kappa is less than 8-thirds. And then you can take, you know, weighted combinations of those measures and also get things that will satisfy our condition. So you see, if you just things in terms of scaling limit of percolation, and if you don't condition a priori about your crossing event, then you've got a mixture between situation where you hook up like this always and situation when you hook up like this. And then the relative weight between these two situations is essentially Cardy's formula.
So there's some notational incoherence with Van Den Stoke, because this nu here is obviously the mu here in Van Den Stoke.
Okay, so I got this messy way that, yeah. Okay, so let me check. So this time is not okay.
The left one is the same as the first one. Okay, so this is, I think, correct. So you take, so you've got this loop measure, which is written new here, but. And you take the measure of loops that intersect gamma j and intersect the union of gamma I, where I is less than j, right? And then you sum over j.
So you should also have that a company finish back the bigger one for a double counting loops.
Oh yeah, I'm double counting loops, yeah.
I can't intentionally double count.
Okay, let me think of it, but I think you know very well this when kappa is 2. So when kappa is 2, what we've got is this non-intersection condition in Fermi's formulae. So we had this, in Fermi's formulae, we had this funny condition that, right, so we've got x1, x2, x3, y1, y2, y3. And what was our condition? So we take the loop erasure of the first hook, right, speaking correct, and then we ask that the second hook doesn't intersect the loop erasure of the first hook. And then we ask that the third walk doesn't intersect the loop erasure of the first two walks. So this is the sum of my.
There should be no loop that intersects two.
And then the third walk is its loops plus its loop erasure, right? So this is this sequential expression.
So if you did it independently, there should be no loop in the loop two.
Okay, so you see that this is not symmetrical. So this is something. So there's a comment in Fermi's paper saying, okay, this procedure is not symmetrical in the indexing of my.
They have a loop that intersects all three of them because they get counted too many times.
Yeah. No. Okay. So this is equivalent. So I can rewrite this. So this sets of loops are not disjoint, so they're double counting. And now, if you don't want if you want to write it in the symmetric fashion, then you've got something like this. So sum over j of nu of loops such that delta intersects at least j of the gamma I. So this is symmetric in the gamma I, and this is just, you know, inclusion exclusion starting from this. So from j going from 2 to okay, so this is actually correct. And now to run, you can rewrite this, and then now if you really want symmetric and notable cutting. No, okay, so it's okay. So it's just something like sum of j minus 1 times nu times the measure of loops that intersect exactly j of the traces. So then that's double cutting because everything says that to change this equation. Okay, so this density function is actually symmetric in the gamma eyes. So now, so the point about the condition kappa less than 8/3 is that now this is between 0 and 1, so we've got something which has a bounded density with respect to probability measure, and we just normalize this, and everything goes okay. So now, if kappa is somewhere between 8/3 and 4, then this is unbounded, and it's reasonable to hope that this has finite expectation under this product measure, so I can still define this joint measure. And then you also get a mixture. Okay, so now back to the again in this situation when I've got no spectator points but only seeds. So I've got two N seeds. So now commutation relation with two N seeds are equivalent to solving a system of N PDEs. And now you can solve the system of N PDEs using, you get Euler integrals for representing solution of this system. So in a sense, somehow you classify completely your solution. Under this, this not so nice form. So the point is that this system, maybe I didn't stress it enough. So when you take a look at this system, so this is a system of PDEs that must have a finite solution space. And if you work a little harder, you see that the solution space can have a dimension at most Cn, where Cn is Catalan's number. So we've got an adequation between the integrability of the system really the geometric meaning of it. Also, I'm looking at John. So this is these are the systems for correlation function of H12 primary fields. So this is something which is which has been known for ages. But we get it purely from this commutation condition consideration. So we get a geometric derivation of these equations. Okay, so we get this system. So now we've got. So the only issue there is to. So if you're not, completely familiar with Euler integrals, so parameters of. My variables are the x, so x1 through x2n, and I've got n minus 1 integration variables. And when I integrate out these n minus 1 integration variables, then I've got a function of my parameters. And this function is the solution of my system. So this is some algebraic identity, in fact. So this is like integration by part, if you want. And, so the indication, you've got to integrate this over a cycle for, twisted Durham cohomology, so this is a bit annoying, and it's a common problem, but it's hard to find which cycle corresponds to what probability, probabilistic event. So there's some ongoing work by, Kenyon and Wilson, that starting from discrete models, also tackle this kind of issue. So finding the proper linear combination of partition functions corresponding to a given probabilistic event. So this is an important technical order. And also, I must stress that when kappa is 8, everything is becomes very nice. And you can express your partition functions in terms of determinants of period matrices of hyperelliptic curves. So you've got sort of compact formula and quite elegant, giving you partition functions corresponding to kappa equals 8. So this is the uniform spanning tree situation, and you can just get back to the discrete model and then use Wilson algorithm, plug in your formula that you get from here, so with all these hyperelliptic periods, and then by comparing hyperelliptic differential forms with harmonic measure with normal reflection, you can just check that this is exactly what you wanted. So you can exactly express the drift terms in terms of the determinant and just check from directly from the discrete model that this is what you get. And when kappa is 2, this is like an awful way to express Tomlin's formula, but this is still Tomlin's formula. Okay, so let me just end up with some two applications of this. So this is like percolation, FLE, and somewhat workshop. So let's give an application to percolation. So you take a regular hexagon, and then edges are alternately blue and yellow. So maybe you want, so this is a good geometry for the triangular lattice, but. And now you take a look at the event that there's a yellow crossing connecting these two yellow edges, and there's a blue crossing connecting these two blue edges. So this is given by the cross-form formula here. So there are only five possible configurations for the hexagon, so you've got three configurations of this type, right? So you can, you know, move like this, etc. So you've got three configurations like this. And you've got two Mercedes configurations. Where these three boundary components are connected in the domain by a cluster. So probability of this event is so by just normalization related to this event. So this is for percolation. And now we also discussed a bit FLE in multiply connected domains earlier. So one of our problems about the drift terms is that a priori the drift terms that we had were functions of a certain number of parameters. And what were these parameters? They were moduli of our configuration set. And somehow we managed to deal with to get a finite solution space if you had enough seeds. So if you don't have too many moduli given the number of seeds, then what you get is a finite classification of possible laws and distributions. So now you can ask that in multiply connected domains, so we always have moduli space that are not points. And then we want to define relevant drift terms. So we want to see what are the relevant FLEs in multiply connected domain. And, well, I mean, so you can ask just for reversibility, right? So reversibility tells you that if this is the interface of something, then the orientation is completely spurious. So if the orientation is spurious, then you want to have reversibility. That is to say that you can go your SLE from either endpoint. If you've got reversibility, then reversibility on Markov, then you've got the Markov property we saw, so the joint Markov property, given exploration starting from two ends. And if you've got Markov, then you've got infinitesimal commutation. So if you start from something which has any physical relevance, then you've got to solve infinitesimal commutation relations. So this gives us some really non-trivial information about what kind of drift terms we can put there. So in the simply connected domains, we saw that there is a very close relationship between the commutation construction and the restriction machinery. So we could use these loops and so on and so forth. So to some extent, we get the same thing. So when kappa is 6, our commutation condition boils down to PDE for percolation events. Same thing. When kappa is 8-3, our commutation condition boils down to the PDE for restriction events. So we had a particular case that was discussed earlier by Robert, but you can work this out for general Schwarz kernels, and you've got some constellations that involve some general properties of Schwarz kernels. And you can see that these two are equivalent, so you can recover this restriction event PDE. So the interesting things to observe, and I mean, this also is something which somehow is discussed by was discussed by Vincent in this series. So why what the compensation by loop sums that we could use in simply connected domain somehow fails for general genus. And then you can actually quantify it algebraically by this commutation condition. So you just work through this, and then you write your commutation condition, and then you compare it with restriction PDs, and well, it's not the same thing because now you've got central charge time something. And something is non-zero if you're not in a simply connected domain. So we got an issue there, which well you can understand like, from first principles that you can actually quantify completely. And if you look inside these integrability conditions that are satisfied, that are implied by commutation and reversibility, then you see that restriction is not the thing that will give you the answer when kappa is not x. So I think I'll conclude on this.